Good morning, all of you out there in podcast land. Unless you're not listening in the morning, in which case, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. It's been nice talking to you. Oh, wait, I still have a podcast to do, don't I? This is the Og Blog Podcast, and I'm Nat Gertler, the Og Blogger, the guy with an excessive love for Peanuts books. How excessive? Well, while for many people, Christmas is the greatest time of year, my greatest time of year comes months earlier when new editions of book adaptations of A Charlie Brown Christmas come out. And I win in that one, because while Christmas only comes once a year, new editions of A Charlie Brown Christmas books have been coming out on an average of several times a year. But it wasn't always that way. In fact, back before I was born, there were no book adaptations of A Charlie Brown Christmas at all, which is understandable because the TV special hadn't aired yet. Which is nice, because it means I didn't miss any of my favorite day. A Charlie Brown Christmas and I were born in the same year, 1965. And that's also the year that the first book adaptation came out. And I'm going to focus on that original adaptation. Now, there's a phrase, original adaptation, for this podcast. Believe me, I could do a whole series of podcasts on book adaptations of A Charlie Brown Christmas in general. And I think I will. I'm not sure yet whether you'll get them all in a row or whether I'll intersperse them with other episodes, but expect multiple episodes on this topic by the end of the year. As you may recall, the TV special A Charlie Brown Christmas was created in a relative rush, a matter of 6 months between the time that the Coca-Cola people asked for a Peanuts Christmas special and when the show aired December 9th, 1965. But the book had to be produced on even more of a rush schedule, can't start adapting the TV special until the contents of the special were at least clearly plotted out, and while the TV special just had to have one copy that got broadcast out by the network, a book had to go to the printer, be reproduced, and hopefully be in stores before the TV special aired so that folks who liked the special could immediately buy one. Going by the copyright record, the book had a publication date of November 29th, 1965, a week and a half before the show hit air. Now, Schultz did not tackle adapting the special to book form all by himself. That's understandable. He was, after all, very much involved with the creation of a primetime TV special at the same time he was holding down his day job, which was turning out a popular daily comic strip, and likely dealing with other licensing matters involved in the vast popularity of that strip at that moment. So he reached out to an artist named Dale Hale. Dale, as some of you may know, worked in Schultz's studio during the late 1950s. He and Schultz had gotten to know each other back when they were both working at Art Instruction School, and he and Schultz had moved out to California together to set up the studio. He was one of Schultz's assistants, doing things like cleaning up the strip, that's erasing stray pencil marks and such after the inked drawing is done, and eventually creating some of the Peanuts comic book stories of the time. I interviewed Dale about this back in 2000 for an article that first ran in Hogan's Alley magazine. You can see that interview on the Og.com website. I'll put a link to the interview in the blog posting for this episode. He was part of the studio until 1960, when he headed off to make his own name. But it was several days after the interview was done that Dale reached out to me in a note that he'd forgotten to mention his final Peanuts gig, which was drawing that first book adaptation of A Charlie Brown Christmas. That's not something he'd been credited for. There's no specific art credit on the book. I reached out to Dale recently for an interview specifically about that book, and while he was genial about it, it became clear that he feels he's spent enough time talking to people about stuff he did 50 years ago. As well he should. He has had quite a story life beyond Peanuts. He has worked on a number of popular newspaper comic strips and had a good run of his own strip Figments. He did TV and movie work. You can find his credits on Tiny Toons, on Pink Panther, and yes, my fellow nerds, on the animated Star Trek series. He ultimately saw himself more as a story guy than as an art guy. Now he's in his 80s, he's retired, he seems fairly robust for his age, and if he wants to spend his time playing his ukulele rather than being on some nerd's podcast, more power to him. But he was generous enough to answer a few questions for me, so I got a better sense of how things went down. Schultz and Melendez were already full bore into the effort on making the special when Schultz reached out to him. He came to see them, and what they had for the book was a 2- or 3-page document with the text and with, in at least some cases, little rough sketches for what the art should be. With that in hand, Dale had the grand total of 2 weeks to turn out the art for a 48-page book. Obviously, it got done in time, and the book landed where it should. The art style of the book is interesting. Hale is largely doing an imitation of Schultz in shape. It's not as fully an imitation of Schultz's Hale's work on the comic book was, it has a bit more of that simpler, clean animation look, without some of the roughness that accompanies the animation. Obviously, even on a rushed book, one could put more time in on each of the roughly 50 single images that make up the interior of the book than on 20-some minutes of animation with multiple drawings per second. The cover image, I should add, is genuine Schultz. It's a picture that was used in other promotion of the special as well. The book adaptation uses an interesting color palette. For example, there's a little that's really red inside. There's a little orange, but a lot of use of pink. You have boys and girls alike wearing pink caps, pink coats. The brick wall that the kids lean on is pink. The book adaptation saw its first printing in November 1965, as I said, and you may think you have a first printing, and if so, you're likely wrong. Most publishers will put on a book's copyright page the month and year that the edition was first published, as well as what printing this copy is, and the year of the printing. Sometimes these are special sort of number line to do that. Sometimes it's flat-out text, but not the World Publishing Company. Not with this book, at least. No, on the first printing, they put First Printing, 1965, on the copyright page, and just left that there for all the other printings. So they all look like first printings. But I've done some detective work on this. There are copies of the World Publishing adaptation with dust jackets. You know, that paper cover that's wrapped around a hardcover book, but isn't actually attached. Now, that wouldn't be telling in itself, but all of these dust jacketed editions were a different size from the most common hardcover edition. Both editions are 9 inches wide, but whereas most copies are 7.5 inches tall, the dust jacketed one is about an inch taller. And just to keep things confusing, there are later copies that height done for a box set, but those have no dust jacket. The dust jacketed copies are scarce. It took me a fair while to land one. The copy that I have used to belong to Florence S. Sherwin. I can tell because she put a book plate in it. That's one of the things I love about used books. They carry bits of their stories with them. There's one copy of a Charlie Brown Christmas adaptation where I can be pretty sure that it was not first printing because it has a Merry Christmas 1971 message written in it. Now, it's not likely that both the dust jacketed edition and the non-dust jacketed edition were issued in 1965. After all, nobody thought that the Christmas special was going to be as big as it became. It hardly seems the time for a multi-format push. So, why do I think that the taller edition came first? Here are my clues. The cover art fits better on the larger edition. The smaller edition has a rather large gutter of black on the right side. This suggests that the design was built around the larger edition and was somewhat clumsily adapted to the smaller one. The smaller copies, I find, mention on the copyright page that this was a Parents Magazine Read Aloud and Easy Reading Program selection. The larger one does not, suggesting that it was published before that selection was made. The clincher for me was when I saw a copy of the book for sale. It had a dust jacket, and they said it's a reviewer's copy. Likely, that means it's either stamped as a review copy or they have the cover sheet that was sent out with the review copy. And I'll admit that I didn't spend the $1,150 they asked for the copy to find out which. And review copies are something one sends out when a book is first published. So when was the squatter version published? I'm guessing that they blew through the real first printing in the first year when the special proved so popular, and then switched to the short one. And even on the shorter edition, it's clear that they aren't all the same printing. There are variances in the shorter version. Some have an asterisk above the printed in the United States of America line. Some do not. For the curious, the larger version had a cover price of $2.50. It has nice red end papers that are lacking in the later printings. The jacket flaps have images from the adaptations and an explanation of the full plot. Really, one could argue that the flaps are themselves yet another adaptation of the special. And then they finish up with this paragraph. The author. Charles M. Schultz is the best-selling author of Peanuts and many other books. His cartoons and daily comic strips are syndicated in more than 500 newspapers all over the world. Doesn't that sound perfectly like it was written by someone who needed to fill out two sentences and didn't have two sentences worth of knowledge? While all technically correct, Schultz was a best-selling author. He did author a book titled Peanuts, but that book wasn't a bestseller, and the books that were bestsellers were Peanuts books. He did have some cartoons syndicated which weren't daily comic strips. The Young Pillars material was syndicated to some church papers. With all that, it doesn't sound like something one would write unless one was desperate to reach 33 words. The credits on this book, by the way, are by Charles M. Schultz, adapted from a Bill Melendez production. That's interesting not only because it doesn't mention Dale Hale, of course, but because it isn't real clear on what's being adapted. The source was a TV special. Of course, we all recognize that now, but that first week that the book was on sale, before the special aired, there's got to be some people who bought it just seeing it as a Peanut storybook, not recognizing what it was. If the special had never aired, this thing would just be, well, I don't want to say another storybook, because this was really before they were making children's storybooks of Peanuts. But adaptations had a different place in the world back then, and I'm not sure that the younger folks would appreciate that. Back then, you saw a TV show when it was on TV, and that was a specific moment. Then it was gone, and it might rerun eventually, and it might not. And you saw movies when they were in one of the local theaters, and this was the days before multi-screen theaters were at all common. There are a few examples before the mid-60s, really. So you saw movies during the week or two that they were in the nearby theater, and then years later there might be a showing on TV, or there might be a revival run, but you couldn't watch things when you wanted them. VCRs were introduced in 1963, but no one you knew had one for over a decade to come. Now, we can watch any show in the month after it aired via on-demand and stream large libraries of material, and we can buy DVDs. We have lots of ways of having permanent access to video materials. Even things that haven't legally been made available, we can download from a pirate site. We shouldn't, I don't, but we could. The idea of not being able to watch just about everything that has existed that we might ever want to watch has disappeared. But there were decades of movies and television before that was true, and adaptations into print form were a thriving business. There were novelizations of many movies. I've got a copy of the novelization of Miracle on 34th Street. There were comic book adaptations. There are book and record sets which bring you actual audio of the work. These were all ways to experience a story when you can't actually see the video. There are some extreme examples of this. For example, there were a fair number of comic book adaptations of movie musicals, which in itself seems silly because you don't actually get music in the print form. I actually own a page of the original art to an adaptation that Marvel Comics did of the film Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, a rather notorious picture adapted loosely from a play, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band on the Road, that was inspired by the work of the Beatles. They used lots of songs from the album in that movie, including Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. Comedian George Burns played Mr. Kite in the movie. So the comic book has an adaptation of a movie that was adapting a play and has a scene that's adapting a song that was in itself an adaptation of a circus poster that was an adaptation of the circus act itself. Adaptations run deep. Perhaps the most notorious adaptation is the novelization of the movie Dune, which wasn't itself an adaptation of the classic science fiction novel Dune, but for some reason they decided to get some lesser writer to turn it back into a book, which probably has a lot more to do with who gets the money from sales of the adaptation than with whether it was actually a good idea. On the other hand, while the movie adaptation of Dune cut chunks out of the book until it didn't make much sense, the Marvel Comics adaptation of the movie cut chunks out of the movie until it made sense again. And that's all a bit of a digression, I admit. But becomes interesting when you realize that the next format of adaptation that was done to A Charlie Brown Christmas was making it a play. The very next year, a high school put on a stage production of A Charlie Brown Christmas, and I'm in a bit of a rush producing this episode and cannot quickly pull up my clipping from the newspaper that covered it. So I cannot give you name and place. And it's bugging me because not only do I have the article, in the same file I have a photograph of the play, the original of the picture that ran in the paper. Anyway, I did do research on it, and the school does not exist anymore, so my hopes of digging up details on this production have greatly shrunk. But I have to reckon this. If they performed it in 1966, What did they have to use as a script? They couldn't have thought to scribble down the contents of the show as it was airing for the first time in 1965. So probably, either they reached out to Schultz and got permission to do a play and some sort of copy of the script that the special used. And that's all possible. Schultz was generous in letting schools use peanuts for their yearbook. And this was before the existence of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown would put a crimp in anyone else trying to do a peanuts play. Or they simply used the book as a guide. The latter sounds more possible. They were adapting the book that adapted the show. Now, that Dale Hale adaptation had a bit of a life. There was that original edition published by the World Publishing Company in the U.S., which was also published in Canada by Nelson, Foster, and Scott. I've never seen a copy with the Nelson, Foster, and Scott imprint on it. They may have just distributed copies marked with World Publishing Company. I don't know. And then there was that slightly physically shorter edition that I mentioned, probably printed the next year. And in 1967, there was a mass-market paperback edition published by Signet. And that one was kind of weird. When I say mass-market paperback, in the trade that means a specific size of paperback. In Peanuts book terms, we're talking about the size of a Fawcett Crest edition. Standard sizing was very important because it let books be sold off of standard racks in grocery stores, drug stores, and the like. But it's a problem for A Charlie Brown Christmas because that's by nature a horizontally oriented book, and mass market paperback editions are vertically oriented. So what they did was put out a book where it looks like you open it like a calendar. The spine of the book is at the top, and you flip the cover up. But if you do, you discover that the whole book is sideways. You have to rotate it. The cover is now sideways. But what they've got is a horizontal book that can be racked in a vertical space with a properly viewed cover. Now, in 1969, Signet put out another paperback edition, not a mass-market paperback, formatted more like the original hardcover edition. They removed the page numbers for some reason, though, possibly only to give people like me something to talk about. Around 1970, possibly 1969, but certainly no earlier, the World Publishing Company put out a box sets of the Peanuts special adaptations they'd done to that point. So that included a hardcover of A Charlie Brown Christmas. And I was back to the height of the original edition, but without a dust jacket. It had to match the height of all the other books, of course, that they were putting into a box set, so they all look nice and even. In 1970, there was the only foreign translation I've yet seen of the Hale adaptation, Notenis Jurebuk. I assume I'm pronouncing that very incorrectly, was a Norwegian edition. I do not have one. I should have one. The world is not just. In 1972, the World Publishing Company reissued the book in a vertical hardcover format, reusing one of the Hale art pieces from inside as the cover. The Schultz cover just didn't fit in the vertical format. It's a tall book. It's part of a set of vertical reworkings of their Peanuts adaptations. My suspicion is that these were done to sell in the supermarkets, much like this Charlie Brown encyclopedia. But that's just a guess. In 1977, we saw the first non-Dale Hale adaptation of A Charlie Brown Christmas. I'll talk about that more on another episode, but the important part here was that it was the end of reprinting the Hale edition for 30 years. In 2007, there was an edition that was sold exclusively by Barnes & Noble. It reprinted the Dale Hale adaptation, but the book was made extra thick to hold a snow block. Basically a rectangular snow globe. You shake it and snow falls on a figure of Charlie Brown and the poor little Christmas tree. It must have done okay, because the next year Barnes & Noble offered the adaptation again, and again with the same snow block. Only this time, instead of building the snow block into the book, both the book and snow block came in a box together. The most recent use of the Dale Hale version came in 2015, when Walmart had an exclusive offering to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the special. A set of two music CDs, the soundtrack of A Charlie Brown Christmas and another Peanuts music disc, which came with a vertical pamphlet edition of the adaptation with reset text. Also included were some cards of not particularly Christmassy Peanuts art. So that's 50 years of use right there, and it would not surprise me for the work to surface again. And speaking of surfacing again, I gotta get going. I'm working really last minute on this episode, and I'll surface again next week. Keep sending me your comments at questions@augh.com. That's AAUGH.com. If you get this podcast through Apple Podcasts, be sure to give this the rating you think it deserves. And until next time, may everything that's special in your life be adaptable. May your friends realize that you're not such a bad little tree and wrap you in stolen decorations. And may all your griefs be good ones.